A new month, a new fiscal year. Same old, not so great economy, though. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the first day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let us take stock, shall we, here at the beginning of a program on business and the economy, of the state of business and this economy. Because honestly, could be better. Here are just a couple of numbers from today's news. 837,000 people lost their jobs last week. Personal incomes were down almost 3% in August and related. And to be clear, time is running out for help from the federal government. There is no deal as of yet, which means that all across the country, from neighborhoods around Disneyland to the outer boroughs of New York City, people are facing a coronavirus winter kind of on their own. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst gets us going from New York.
At St. Anne's Episcopal Church in the Bronx, the line to get food often wraps around the block. It's a mix of young people, children, and elderly. The Bronx is part of the poorest congressional district in the U.S. Many people who live here commute to Manhattan, often to work minimum wage and essential jobs. Locals tell me they've never seen anything like this line before. A man named Garrett Faber said he comes here once a month to get food because his unemployment check.
It's not quite enough because, you know, my bills are pretty high. And I pay rent and, I have other bills. I have student loans.
He's a social worker who lost his job. The Bronx is the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic in New York City. The area I'm standing in, Mott Haven, has had over 1,500 COVID cases. Unemployment here is now around 25%, according to analysts. That's Great Depression levels.
When the economy gets a cold, places like Bronx get pneumonia or cancer.
Joel Berg is the CEO of the nonprofit Hunger Free America. He says life can be very tough for many residents in the South Bronx, but COVID has been catastrophic.
And so their tenuous living before this, when they were just at the edge of survival, has been destroyed.
Erica Groshen is a senior economic advisor at Cornell University. She says jobs in Manhattan created what economists call
multiplier effects. You know, how many jobs does each job support?
A lot. So as Manhattan offices remain mostly empty, many janitors, baristas, cooks, and other workers who call the Bronx home have seen their jobs disappear. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
You lose a job, of course, more happens than just going without a paycheck. A lot more happens. So we asked Marketplace's Eric Barris to talk to some workers who'd been furloughed.
Back in April, Monica Harris was furloughed from her digital marketing job in the Atlanta area. At first, she was optimistic.
Maybe this is the time, like, I need to just be, like, doing other stuff, working on some passion projects, like, just stuff like that.
Then her furlough was extended, and her extra unemployment benefits ran out. She spent the summer worrying.
I hope I'm not the next Breonna Taylor. I hope my fiancé is not the next George Floyd.
And now she expects to be out of work for the rest of the year.
Last month was probably the hardest out of the whole time I haven't been working that I really was feeling like, oh my God, like, am I going to be okay?
The pandemic, the struggle for social justice, the uncertainty surrounding the election, add in unemployment, and the stress can be overwhelming, says Art Goldsmith, an economist at Washington and Lee University who studies how joblessness affects mental health.
All sorts of insecurities undermine emotional well-being. And this is a classic case of that because you just don't know. And employers don't know either.
PSA Airlines flight attendant Danita Grosti starts her furlough today.
I live right next to the Philadelphia airport. So whenever planes go to land or take off, often hear them. And it's sad. It's very sad.
As is not knowing whether she'll go back to work on a plane. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
There was a whole lot of optimism today on Wall Street early, and then there was less. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shopping. We are as you know, doing more of it online. And once global trade started picking back up after that initial shock early in this thing, imports have been booming since. The ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, the busiest port complex in the country, we will point out, have seen record imports the past couple of months. There has been pent-up demand, of course, and oh, by the way, holiday inventory buildups. There has been so much shipping, in fact, that importers are running out of room to store everything. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
When products arrive at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, port workers unload them onto trucks or rail cars, and those are shipped across the country to distribution centers.
Let's say in the Midwest somewhere, it could be Chicago, Ohio Valley.
William Villalon, the president of APL Logistics, says problem is things haven't been moving very quickly.
They're just being parked because they can't be taken into the warehouses fast enough.
Social distancing is slowing down the unloading process. Truck chassis and rail car capacity are in short supply. And warehouses are packed to the rafters. Available capacity is at its lowest level since 2018, says Zach Rogers at Colorado State University. He runs the Logistics Managers Index, which tracks supply and demand in the shipping industry.
COVID-19 has supercharged the warehouse sector because of the increased reliance on e-commerce.
And with the holidays approaching, Rogers says retailers are competing for whatever storage space they can find.
That's really driving up the cost of warehousing because we don't have very many warehouses available.
Warehouse rents in Southern California are up roughly 10% compared to a year ago, says Jason Tolliver at the commercial real estate services firm Cushman & Wakefield. Retailers are paying that premium and not passing it along to consumers as they head into the holiday season.
Trying to avoid the worst word that they could possibly hear, which is stock out.
The boom in e-commerce is prompting developers to build more warehouses, especially in urban areas.
The market appears very healthy with sufficient levels of demand to really eat up a lot of that space that I think is going to be delivered over the course of this year and next year.
The ports themselves are scaling up too. Mario Cordero is the executive director of the Port of Long Beach, which has spent roughly $4 billion on infrastructure improvements over the last decade.
And for the next decade, approximately $2 billion, primarily in rail infrastructure.
The idea, he said, is to cut trucks out of the equation, which will move goods faster and be good for the environment. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Layoffs today and this week, this whole pandemic, as you know, are the macroeconomic story. And it's not just here in this country either. The World Tourism Organization says the pandemic could put anywhere between 100 million and 120 million jobs at risk. And that in turn brings us to our latest installment of
What's Up?
What's Up?
What's Up, World?
What's Up, World? We go north of the border. I love that thing. We go north of the border today. Shelley Frost is the president and CEO of the Pacific National Exhibition up in Vancouver, Canada. Ms. Frost, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me today.
So for those who are not familiar with the Pacific National Exhibition up in Vancouver, what is it? What do you guys do?
That's a great question. We are a $60 million a year nonprofit organization. We have a fair that we run every year. We run an amusement park, and year round we do music festivals, concerts, sporting events, community events, and we also work in the film industry. So when we have assets that are not being utilized, they're used by film production crews up here.
Let's get to film in a minute, but all of those things you reeled off in the beginning of that answer sound like things that a pandemic would be not great for.
You bet. It's been absolutely devastating for us. A $60 million organization, we've confirmed a loss of $52 million this year. That's devastating to an organization. We've got a $200 million economic impact and 4,300 employees. We've got 4,100 employees not working right now.
I'm sorry, 4,100 of 4,200 are not working.
You bet.
Wow.
You know, we've been obviously doing everything that we can to work within the health guidelines to bring back smaller events, do the kind of business that we can do. But we're good at doing large scale events and, you know, concerts with 10, 12,000 people. Obviously not things that we can do in a pandemic. And so we're trying like everybody else to pivot and do things differently, but challenging for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk about the pivot. Film production is working out for you?
Yeah, you know, a film, the industry came out really strong as soon as our phase two opened up. Mm-hmm. We've been thrilled to have so many productions come back up to BC. You know, film space is absolutely at a premium. Mm. Most places are turning film clients away, and there just right now is not enough set deck space or film production or office space really in the Lower Mainland.
We should point out that Vancouver and British Columbia and the entire country of Canada are doing better than most parts of the United States in terms of handling this virus. How are you banking on things staying this way, that you'll be able to retain this kind of film production capacity?
You know, it's cyclical all the time, and it depends a lot on the foreign exchange. It depends on, you know, a lot of different economic factors that are going on down in the States as well. But there's a baseline that stays strong, and we see spikes in it at any given time. I do think that film production will stay strong in Vancouver and in the Lower Mainland for the next while. I think BC specifically has done a really great job of managing the pandemic and keeping the curve flattened to a degree that it's not putting a lot of pressure on our healthcare system. I think that's given people a lot of comfort in coming up here and knowing that they can film safely. And we've got a lot of big sites. So, you know, at the P&E, for an example, we've got production companies coming in and taking over 2, 3, or 4 buildings at a time because they can keep their pods together, their bubbles together, and they can do their screening on site really, you know, effectively and not be, you know, spread out between a lot of different sites.
Yeah, I have to say, you sound remarkably positive for a woman who's audience who's running an organization. You know where I'm going, right? Your audiences are down. You're losing $52 million in revenue. I mean, come on, right?
You know what? Honestly, it's funny that you say that. But the one thing that I do know for sure is that the P&E's been around for 110 years. There's fewer than 3% of organizations that ever make it through 100 years.
Yeah.
There's no question in my mind that we have the kind of team and innovation that's going to get us out of this. But, you know, as the president and CEO, I have to be looking forward to a positive future. And I'm staying very focused on what we can do and not what we can't.
Shelley Frost, pushing ahead. She's the president and CEO of the Pacific National Exhibition up in Vancouver, British Columbia. Ms. Frost, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
Hey, do me a favor. Would you take 10 minutes tomorrow morning? Catch the Marketplace Morning Report. David Brancaccio and the team. All you need to know to start your economic day. Coming up.
That part of our business is kind of like a catfish. We just kind of pick up what's on the bottom.
Can't wait to hear that one. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 35 today, 10th percent, 27,816. The NASDAQ up 159 points, about 1.4%, 11,326. The S&P 500 up 17 points, 0.5%, 33.80. Here are some sports betting news. The popular platform DraftKings has signed a multi-year deal with the Philadelphia Eagles, making DraftKings the official daily fantasy sports partner and sports betting partner of that team. Because DraftKings stock up 5% today. Shares in textbook publisher Houghton Mifflin. Houghton Mifflin, right? Houghton Mifflin? I don't know. Anyway, stacked up 16% as company announced a restructuring plan. It's been tough for them and the whole textbook industry at large, hit hard by the shift to online instruction across universities and K-12 nationwide. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note, 0.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Telehealth, for obvious reasons, got really big at the beginning of the pandemic. And in that way that things work the way they're supposed to sometimes, a lot of insurance companies started waiving copays for telehealth visits so people would stay home and not add to the stress that hospitals were under. And people did. Now, though, some big insurers are going to start charging those fees again, which means the cost of seeing a doctor virtually could be the same as the cost of going in person. And as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, incentives in life and in behavioral economics matter.
Dr. Chad Illimudel still dresses up for work, even on days when all his appointments are virtual.
The video takes a little formality out of it, so I kind of raise the formality by wearing a white coat.
Illimudel is a urologist. He also directs a telehealth research incubator at the University of Michigan. And he says dressing the part is important because he wants patients to know they're getting the same treatment online as they would in person. He says reintroducing copays?
There's no doubt that it will leave some people less interested in doing a video consultation.
And that's really part of the point. to push patients back to seeing a doctor in person, because people have been putting off important exams and procedures that couldn't be done virtually. Ativ Mehrotra, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard, says during the pandemic, inpatient care has dropped by 60%.
And that led to a lot of morbidity and mortality at home because they were so scared to get care.
Insurance companies might also be worried that no copays meant too many people were making virtual appointments for fairly minor complaints. Brietta Clark teaches healthcare law at Loyola Marymount University.
Cost sharing is thought to help reduce unnecessary visits, or at least that's the theory.
But she says copays, which can cost as much as $100, can discourage people from getting necessary medical help. And reintroducing copays will force some people to go back to weighing what's more important, putting dinner on the table or seeing a doctor. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The hospitality industry, as we know, has suffered mightily these past 6 or 7 months. Lost business, lost jobs, and lost income. In a lot of places, though, accommodations have been made to let restaurants open up outside or with limited capacity to ease some of that economic pain. Not so for bars, as Marketplace's Sabree Benishore found out.
Kelly Spaulding owns Katmandu's. It's a bar in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. She was able to open for about a month during the pandemic, and then the bars had to shut down again.
Just because you're shut down and you're not bringing in any money, that don't stop the utility bills from coming in. That don't stop the taxes from having to be paid. Our funds are almost completely depleted. We cannot go on much longer.
In Michigan, like in a lot of places around the country, the rules for reopening have been very different for bars versus restaurants. After an outbreak in June at a Lansing nightclub with a packed dance floor, Michigan shut down any business that makes 70% or more from alcohol sales. But Spaulding says her bar is not a nightclub.
There's just no rhyme or reason. Like, what makes a difference if you serve alcohol or if you serve food? So now the restaurants are completely packed.
In a lot of cities and states, public health departments have been suspicious of bars and the behavior of their patrons.
They're higher risk broadly from a COVID perspective.
Dr. Allison Arwadi is commissioner of the Chicago Department of Public Health.
And as people are drinking more, we sometimes see people lose some of the inhibitions, social distancing, et cetera.
Until recently, Chicago closed bars that don't serve food. New York still has a similar rule. Arwady says food slows down people's buzz. And she says the differential treatment between bars and restaurants has been very much intentional, with one age group in particular in mind.
Our 18 to 29-year-olds, and in this case our 21 to 29-year-olds, really have disproportionately been driving a lot of the cases of COVID over the summer. And where we looked at their activities, they were disproportionately going to bars. I mean, it's not a surprise.
As of last week, all Chicago bars are allowed open, but at 25% capacity, while restaurants can open at 40%. North Carolina has taken a much stricter approach. All standalone bars are closed entirely, no exceptions. Zach Medford owns 3 bars in Raleigh and says bars suffer from an unwarranted stigma.
There's a misconception that all private bars are tight spaces with packed dance floors and people breathing all over each other. But in reality, these days, most bars are more like Cheers than they are like Studio 54.
Many bar owners across the country, sensing the demise of swaths of their industry, have emphasized their cultural role. Michael Klein is president of the Texas Bar and Nightclub Alliance in San Antonio.
You know, countless famous musicians got their start playing happy hour, in a bar on 6th Street.
Klein's group is suing Texas's governor over bar closures. In New York, 2 blocks from Studio 54, which is now a theater, Richard Schaefer stands between 2 gay bars, both closed, one for good.
There's definitely a loss of our culture and what we do.
In New York, only bars that serve food and do so outside have been allowed to open. It's meant that many gay bars remain closed, some permanently. Schaefer used to perform at some of the now defunct bars.
I'm a sober queer person, and I still go to the bars to be around my people. we are, as queer people, limited to the amount of spaces that we actually have. You know, there are designated queer safe spaces for us, just a place that we can personally go and not feel judged in that sense, you know.
According to Yelp, 59 gay bars on their platform are closed nationwide. More than half of them have gone out of business. Increasingly, bar owners and organizations representing them have expressed a sense of desperation. Scott Ellis is a distillery owner and runs the Michigan Licensed Beverage Association.
This industry is so scarred and so beat up that they're willing to do everything and anything.
The bar and nightclub industry once took in $24 billion a year in revenue. Now, Yelp says bars and nightlife establishments have endured an especially high rate of closure. Of the 6,500 that are closed on its platform, 54% are closed permanently. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Here's another indicator out this morning. Consumer spending was up about 1% last month. That is fine and all, but way slower than the growth in it in the mid-pandemic months of May and June. This virus economy, though, hasn't just made a roller coaster of how much people buy, but also of what they buy, as you will hear in today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name's Wayne Hogan. I am located at 304 Main Street, North Little Rock, commonly known as Argenta District. And I sell funky retro vintage home and office, so we do a little everything. We even have some vintage clothes and a grocery store in here with a restaurant. We started our office furniture business out of a garage back in 1982. We got married the same week we started the business. So ever since then, there's times when the business has kept the marriage going, times when the marriage partnership has kept the business going. And there's been strains on both. I tell you, when whatever business is good, we're selling a lot of new office furniture. People really come in and just got plenty of money, just want to get it all new, want to put their own scratches on it. When the economy's slow, then they get a little more frugal. Now, we buy a lot of used office furniture, so we're kind of, that part of our business is kind of like a catfish. We just kind of pick up what's on the bottom and, you know, keep everything stirred up. Right now, on the selling end of it, seems like people are buying more for their house, so the big desks are not what they're looking for. They're looking for smaller desks to replace that kitchen table office right now. You're not going to sell them a six-foot desk when they're just carving out space to do their work. About out of small desks, I got to get out there and find some small desk. Yeah, I think when you pay people to stay at home, they get used to it, and now a lot of people are doing that. So a lot of businesses are downsizing and having their people work from the house. And for that reason, there is a lot of excess furniture that they don't need. I've actually had people just clearing out and just donating stuff. So just giving, you know, just listen, I got to clean this area out. Just come get it. You know, in any downturn like this, there's a opportunity to pick up deals and, you know, recirculate them. But as you approach 60, you're just not that excited about loading trucks. So we're finding some younger guys to do that part.
A lot of truth in there, huh? I'm working off a card table in the shed next to my house. Wayne Hogan, that was. He runs Galaxy Office Furniture with his wife, Linda. They are in North Little Rock, Arkansas. You can tell us about your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, something to consider perhaps as you wait for your food in the drive-thru. Bloomberg picked up on some data from the market research firm C-Level HX. It shows the average time to get a drive-thru order at the 10 biggest fast food chains in this economy is just a hair under 6 minutes, which, it turns out, is about 30 seconds slower than last year. Makes sense, right? Fewer people actually want to go inside. Now, consider 30 seconds times however many millions of us are driving through. You're talking real money. All right, we are going, but not without your Thursday moment of economic context, climate change and green energy edition. We have had, as you know, all kinds of wildfires out here in California the past couple of months. Big new scary ones just the past couple of days up in Northern California. Anyway, saw this in Axios today, a study from the Department of Energy that says all the smoke and ash and gunk in the air has cut how much solar power we can generate. The double whammy is that it's going to be 100 degrees in parts of L.A. today, which is to say we're all going to be running the A.C. because fires come when it's hot, which is when you need all the power that you can get. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.